Public Media at 170millionamericans.org.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 16th, 2011, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Perhaps no issue is more prevalent in the minds of Americans today, or people around the world for that matter, than the state of the economy, where it's going, the troubles it's facing, and the future. We have as our guest today one of the real experts on economics to talk to us about the state of the American economy, the big issues before us, economic issues. We'll have Bob Polin here from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst joining us for the full hour. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
We've all heard stories of unwitting consumers racking up astronomical overages on their cell phones. Their inadvertent data usage costs them hundreds, even thousands of dollars. This kind of bill shock could be avoided if wireless carriers would institute mechanisms for consumers to track their data usage in real time. Last October, the Federal Communications Commission proposed a ruling that would require wireless carriers to notify their subscribers when they near their data limit and disclose overage fees. Several consumer groups filed comments applauding the FCC's approach, including the National Consumers League. John Breo is the Vice President of Public Policy at NCL. He says the options currently available to manage data use are insufficient.
They vary greatly from carrier to carrier as far as how useful they are or the methods that consumers can use. Oftentimes, some of the best features that would help consumers avoid bill shock cost a fee to use. And we think that in order to both provide a baseline of consumer protection across all wireless carriers, there needs to be action at the Federal Communications Commission to put this in place.
The commission is calling on wireless carriers to provide real-time alerts to users when they're exceeding their allotment and alerts when they are incurring high roaming charges. Breo and the other consumer groups think the FCC's proposed rules are common sense, but the groups think that the commission should provide even more protection to users. They want what they're calling a circuit breaker mechanism that would require consumer consent to allow the usage to continue when they are in danger of running up more fees.
So, for example, if you hit your limit for text messaging that month, you would receive a text message from your carrier saying that you're at your limit. Further text messages will cost you X. And do you agree to that? Yes or no? And if you don't agree to it, then you just wouldn't be able to use text messages until the billing cycle resets, or you agree at a later date to those fees, or you purchase an additional plan or an additional bucket of text messages. And then the same could be said for additional voice minutes or additional data.
The FCC bill shock proceeding is open for comments from the public until February 11th. You can go to FCC.gov and respond to dockets 10-207 and 09-158. You can also send letters and emails to the FCC. And you can let your state utility commission know that this is an issue you care about.
In just a few short months, hundreds of people from all over the country will be descending on Boston for the 5th National Conference for Media Reform, a 3-day conference in April devoted to the intersections of media, technology, and democracy. Kara Lisa Berg-Powers, the co-director of the nonprofit youth media organization Press Pass TV in Boston, is also a member of the local host committee helping to organize the conference with Free Press. Powers first attended NCMR in 2008 in Minneapolis as a scholarship recipient. She had a powerful experience and said the conference is a critical organizing space for people who want better media for their communities.
To me, the most important thing about conferences is the ability to sort of re-energize and rededicate people to their collaborative work. Getting to talk to organizations that have been around a lot longer than us was really inspiring for us and helped to not reinvent the wheel, but also connect you to a whole network of people so that you don't feel isolated in your work.
This year, the conference will include nearly 300 speakers and performers, and will give folks the opportunity to attend workshops and panels about creating new media models, supporting public journalism, preserving free speech online, and building a more diverse media landscape. For Powers, NCMR also holds a special place in her heart. It's where she met her husband, Jordan Berg Powers, then outreach coordinator for Free Press.
We got to talk a few times over the 3 days that we were there in Minneapolis, and then exchanged information and started dating soon after, and now been happily married for a year and a half.
As powerful corporations take control of the internet and the mainstream media produces vapid reporting and often inflammatory punditry, Powers says now is the critical time to organize for a better future.
We're at a real turning point moment right now where those of us that believe that the media can feed a more positive vision of our lives and our communities need to come together and really talk about how we bring it back to that. So I think that if you think you should come, you probably should, and that we need your voice in that conversation.
The conference will be held at the Boston Seaport April 8th through 10th. To find out more and to register for the conference, visit freepress.net. To find out about Powers' organization, visit presspasstv.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 16th, 2011, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is one of the leading economists in the country. Bob Poland is a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and he's the co-director of the Political Economic Research Institute based at UMass Amherst. He's written several books, including Contours of Dissent, published in 2003 by Verso, and he writes widely, especially for The Nation magazine. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen his work. Bob Poland, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great being on. Thank you for having me.
Well, you are, I think, an economist who specializes broadly in macroeconomic issues and employment and finance in the green economy. So we're delighted to have someone with your range on the program. Perhaps, Bob Poland, we could start by just talking about, you know, the state of the U.S. economy today. We know it's not especially good, but if you could put it in some sort of historical context, some sort of, you know, where does our economy stand today compared to 30 years ago or 50 years ago? What is your, I mean, what is its, how would you assess it in terms of its, where we are historically in terms of a capitalist economy?
Well, that's a great and very challenging question, Bob. Well, number one, we've gone through the most severe recession that the U.S. economy has experienced since the 1930s. So that's obviously the number one starting point for any view of where we are today relative to the past. But this has been different than the 1930s depression experience, and it is far less severe. The reason that it's far less severe is precisely because of the government interventions that did set a floor to the economy's collapse. The number one was the stimulus program, however inadequate. It did pump hundreds of billions of dollars of government spending into the economy. The second one, again, extremely controversial, extremely bad in many ways, was the bank bailouts. There's no way around it. And the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler. Imagine the economy today if we'd actually let Citibank, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, General Motors, and Chrysler all collapse in early 2009, as they were about to do. I mean, and I don't like any of those organizations, but we can envision a full-scale 1930s-style depression, and the only thing that got us out of that depression was putting government deficit spending at the level of one-third of the whole economy for World War II. So we're not nearly as bad off. So the question is, moving forward, where are we? I mean, if we had had a full-scale depression, it's also probably likely that this neoliberal model that has dominated economics for almost 40 years, 35 years now, would have been completely discredited. Who knows what would have come next? I would have hoped some kind of, you know, coherent left agenda. But because precisely because of all the bailouts that were, you know, mildly successful, there's this period of total confusion in which, you know, the actual populist movement is on the right thinking that the problem is the government. The problem is free market capitalism. The problem was that we let Wall Street run amok, and it's not even clear that people realize that or remember it. They think the problem is the government deficits. Well, the government deficits, however inadequate, are part of the solution. So I think we're in a really a serious phase of confusion, both among people, among activists, and among economists. There was this moment, and I certainly subscribe to it, where I thought neoliberalism was finished. I didn't know what would come next, but I thought there's just no way anyone could take this stuff seriously anymore. But we're back at it, and we're saying the problem is the deficit is too big, and we've got to. I mean, the cover of The Economist magazine said, well, now we've got to go after public sector unions. So all of a sudden, the problem is that the public sector unions are too strong. I mean, this is absurd. So I think we're in a period of real confusion. I think that's, in that way, it's comparable to the late 1930s before the World War II solved the Depression, because in the late 30s, we also had a moment where we're saying, well, you know, the government has to cut back, the deficits are too big. So I guess that would be a reasonable comparison in that sense.
Our guest, Bob Polin. And Bob, you just referred to neoliberalism a few times and the neoliberal model. This is a term that's used in academia widely and in the business circles less widely, but not that well known in the broader political discourse.
Right.
What is neoliberalism? What does that term mean?
You're right. I shouldn't. You know, my wife always gets on me for that. She says, I don't know what to say. So neoliberalism actually is a term that's better known in other places in the world. It really refers to a variant of unregulated capitalism. And I said a variant because the real model is it's a very aggressive pro-business model in that it says when business doesn't want to be regulated, fine, they don't have to be regulated. Okay, so like with respect to the financial markets, obviously very important. With respect to labor, the idea that there should be strong labor unions, there should be a minimum wage, there should be a good welfare state that workers can fall back on as needed, all of those things are considered bad. Having a Social Security and public health insurance, they're just kind of burdens on the powerful engine of a free market. On the other hand, and this is the trick with neoliberalism, when they need a bailout, God damn it, they're going to get it. That's also part of neoliberalism in practice, whatever anybody says in theory, because when we under the neoliberal regime, when we started deregulating financial markets, really starting in the late 70s, I mean we've had financial crises every 5 years or so, and we will continue to have them. And what's happened is there have been bailouts. And I mean this last one was the most severe, but it certainly wasn't the first. So the business doesn't want free markets. They love big government when you need big government to bail out a financial crisis.
Our guest, Bob Polin from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, the co-director of the Political Economic Research Institute there, author of many books, including Contours of Dissent. We're here talking about the state of the economy. We'll get into press coverage of economic issues. And if you want to call in with a question or comment for Bob Polin, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bob, one of the things you've written about in The Nation and elsewhere has been the state of inequality in the United States and how it relates to neoliberalism, what we've just been talking about. And also, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. I think that Americans are loosely aware that there's sort of a lot of inequality, but I'm not sure, since it's not commonly talked about by politicians or by in the news media, it's not widely discussed in any sort of empirical level. Just a little bit about that, and then talk a little bit about unemployment, if you would, and its relationship to inequality.
Well, the level of inequality that we have now, that is the, say, the share of either income or wealth, you know, to what everybody owns versus how much is coming in every year, is at a level comparable to the 1920s, right before the Wall Street crash of 1929. I mean, the numbers are actually astounding. The top 1%, or the richest 1% of people, I think over the last 5 years, I can't remember if it's the last 5 years or the last 3 years, but anyway, the basic point is all of the increases in income for the whole economy, the top 1% got one-third. I mean, that means the rest, everybody else, including 2 to 10%, got two-thirds. The top, you know, the richest 1% got one-third. The richest one-tenth of 1% got something like 20% right there. So, I mean, the economy has been completely restructured to operate almost exclusively on behalf of the richest of the rich, and that is very closely intertwined with the deregulation of financial markets and letting Wall Street do what they want. And what they want is, you know, their job is to make rich people richer. And you can't really blame... I'm not one of the ones that gets off on, like, saying how greedy the people on Wall Street are, because we just have to assume that's a given. And the real issue is whether we put laws down that prevent them from being so excessively greedy and channeling all the economy's tremendous resources into positive developments. That is, you mentioned employment. So, you know, why aren't we setting regulations to channel credit into employment-enhancing activities, especially when we have nearly 10% unemployment? Those would be the kinds of things that would challenge the preeminence of Wall Street, and it just doesn't take me very far to say, oh, these people are greedy, and I think we just take that as a given. They've always been greedy, but, you know, in coming out of World War II, we did have regulations, and they were greedy then, but they really had to abide by kind of being caged in. And the cage that they were in enabled the economy to grow in a more egalitarian way.
You talked about the spectacular growth of economic inequality. And one of the lessons I think you thought was going to be learned with the crash of 2008 was that economic inequality was actually bad for our capitalist economy, its functioning. A lesson that seems to, have been instantly forgotten, or largely forgotten, at least by policymakers, looking at the last tax decrease or continuation of tax decrease on the wealthiest Americans.
Well, yes. I mean, so we have a situation, also at this point, I think, unprecedented in American history, where we look at what's happened to average wages for working people that essentially have been stagnant for almost 40 years now, meaning that if you look at the average wage in 1972 and you look at the average wage today, it's actually 7 or 8% lower today than it was 40 years ago, after you correct for inflation. So this is the situation for, and of course for people below the average, it's worse. But that's the average, and these are strictly government statistics I'm working from. Now, at the same time, the average amount that a worker produces, the average productivity, is essentially doubled in 40 years. So the amount of income each worker brings to a company and when they come to work every day has essentially doubled, but the amount they're taking home has fallen by 8 or 9%. So somebody is getting that difference, and that's, of course, The owners of businesses at Wall Street, and the owners and the people in finance. Now, that is, of course, unjust, but it also makes it almost impossible for a capitalist economy to work because capitalism depends on people being able to buy things, and workers don't have enough income to buy what they themselves produce. Part of the way that we solve that, have solved that on a very rickety basis, is household debt. So people borrow more to maintain their living standard while their incomes are stagnating, and that, of course, led to the instability in the financial market. So the extreme inequality leads to financial instability. It worsens living standards for workers. It makes the rich spectacularly rich, but it also destabilizes the very foundations that have made them rich in the first place.
And let's get back, if we can, Bob Holland, to the issue of unemployment, because it strikes me that one of the things that's very interesting, and I'd like your thoughts on this, is that we're now in a situation where it seems like we're gravitating pretty quickly to a point where 8%, 9%, even 10% unemployment is sort of the new 5%. It seems like there's not sort of a recognition of what an extraordinary crisis this is for America to have so many millions of people without work, not merely for the people who are out of work or who are, you know, threatened with being out of work, but with the extraordinary downward pressure this puts on wages for all Americans. Is this sort of something that's taking place without any discussion whatsoever? Am I missing something? Was there
a
debate on this?
You're right. I mean, okay, so first of all, yeah, the official unemployment rate is 9.4%, but even if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the official source of statistics, they include other broader measures that includes people that are working part-time that would like full-time and people that have dropped out of the labor force because they've been discouraged. That gets us to almost 17%. And, you know, if you add people, for example, immigrants that, you know, were legal immigrants and so forth, but went back to their countries because of the lack of employment, we're basically at around 20%. That's one in five. You know, 30 million people, that's double the population of New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And that's roughly the range that we're talking about. So this is an extraordinary crisis, and it has been remarkable to me that this is not seen as the 100% issue that we need to solve. And, you know, instead, we've wasted a few months talking about the deficit commission. We're going to hear a lot more about that with closing a tax on Social Security, a tax on Medicare. That's what's coming up with the new Republican Congress. Meanwhile, we're not doing any of the things that we need to do to fight unemployment. The deficit is a secondary issue. At least one half of the deficit would get closed if we got the unemployment rate down to 5%. So we have the tools. We don't have the political will. We don't have a progressive movement demanding it. And so the Democrats are kind of a weak version of a Wall Street party, and the Republicans are a strong version of a Wall Street party with a very active base with the Tea Party movement that the mainstream people respond to. Whereas the Democrats, it doesn't seem like the mainstream people are responding to its base. That is, people in the social movements and labor movement, the unemployed, the poor. That's supposed to be the base of the Democrats, and we don't really get much on behalf of that.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Bob Poland, the economist from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, author of a number of books, including Contours of Dissent, published in 2003 by Verso. He's the co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute, or Political Economic Research Institute, at UMass Amherst, and he writes for The Nation magazine frequently on economic issues. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Call in. Bob Pullum is really capable of speaking on the broad range of economic issues, so anything goes today if you want to call in and speak with our guest. And, Bob, I want to wrap up on this issue of unemployment and insufficient demand and get to really what is one of the cutting-edge changes also in American society in the last 50 years. And what was once a very controversial area, but now is becoming, I think, almost passé, which is labor unions. We've seen the same time this inequality has grown, as I understand, and you would know the data better than I do, the percentage of private sector workers who are represented by trade unions or labor unions has plummeted. And this seems to have gone hand in hand with the collapse of living standards.
Yeah, it's also gone hand in hand with the collapse of or the decline in manufacturing, so that the private sector unionization rate is somewhere in the range of 7% now. It was at its peak was around 30% in the 1950s. This makes it very, very difficult for workers to get a fair shake in bargaining. That's why, exactly why the wage has not gone up. I mean, kind of the old line in wage bargaining was, well, business says I can give workers a raise as long as productivity goes up. That means as long as the pie is getting bigger, then we each get a share. We keep our same shares, but everybody gets more because productivity makes the pie get bigger. But now the pie has continued to get bigger, sometimes at a slower rate, sometimes at a faster rate. But the pie keeps getting bigger, and workers don't get a share, an increased share. And what they get is stagnant wages and higher unemployment rates. And so who is speaking up for the workers? Well, it is unions, but the unions are right. They're losing their base, and this is very serious. Nevertheless, the unions were absolutely instrumental in getting the Democrats elected in 2008 and supporting Obama, giving him a lot of money, and they aren't getting enough in return. This is an old story that with Clinton and now with Obama, that the Democrats in office tend to take their base for granted, and because they think they can get away with it. And I don't know what the solution is, but I can't imagine that there's going to be an effective progressive movement in this country without effective labor unions. And so we've got to figure out how to get them back revived. I know they're trying, but the success rate has not been impressive.
Yeah, you mentioned manufacturing, Bob Pullum, and I think there's a sense, certainly in our news media, to the extent this issue even gets covered or mentioned, and like unemployment, it almost never does or rarely does. But there's a sense that, with low-wage countries like China is often, where so much manufacturing is done today, or just in Latin America or across the Pacific Rim, that the era of nations like the United States with relatively higher wages doing serious manufacturing is over, and that we have to simply, move on to knowledge industry type jobs, and manufacturing is in our rearview mirror. I got the sense from the way you just answered that last question, you don't think that's such a brilliant idea, and you don't think it's necessarily mandatory for the United States to forego having manufacturing.
Well, I don't think that we're going to be competitive in areas of manufacturing that are heavily based on low-wage labor costs. The classic case being clothing and textiles. Though even there, you could make an argument, and other people have made an argument, that the U.S. could well be competitive. The bigger point is that as you move into higher value-added types of manufacturing, things that require a lot of capital investment, a lot, as you mentioned, knowledge, a lot of technology. Automobiles, but the example that's really important that I've thought about is the green economy. You can be very competitive without having a low-wage labor force, and the level of wages is not the crucial feature in the manufacturing. So if we take, for example, I know that your show is in Illinois, and if we think about the Midwest, there's been a lot of discussion around building this massive wind farm in the Great Lakes. This is something like a $1 trillion project that would create hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Midwest on the wind farms themselves, but also people supplying the wind farms. And this would also advance a clean economy agenda. These are the kinds of things that could revive manufacturing quite effectively, and they're things that we need to have done, and we need, and we, this will create a lot of decent jobs. So, but we need to focus on that. It has to be an industrial policy to say that we're not going to surrender our manufacturing base, and we can create manufacturing jobs that are good jobs and still be highly competitive as long as there is something like a commitment that we now have for the defense budget, which is, you know, extremely effective at producing high-tech weapons and machinery to fight wars and kill people. Why don't we use that same capability to create a green economy and create millions of jobs in the process? That seems to be a huge question overhanging everything here. And I'll just mention, I've had a couple of conversations, actually, with people, not top people, but people in the administration about this. And they asked me, and I'm sure many, many other people, what's a big idea that Obama can throw out in his next State of the Union address, meaning I think it's coming in a week or two. Mm-hmm. And I said exactly what I just described to you. And the first reaction was, oh, that's kind of boring. That's not boring. I mean, it's everything. It's jobs, it's technology, it's green, it's reviving the Midwest. So we'll see how we do with that.
Our guest, Bob Polin. This is Media Matters. I am your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open here at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller right now. Line 1, Champaign County. You're on the air with Robert Polin.
Hi. You've sparked so much in me, it's kind of hard to focus as usual. But I don't know if you're following this internecine battle in the labor unions, where the some of the manufacturing and other private sector unions are sort of going after the public sector along with all the other pundits and analysts and even some in the administration, it seems to me. It's really frightening. It reminds me of the remark by Jay Gould that he was boasting he could hire half of the working class to incarcerate the other half or something. But I was really moved to call earlier about, for one thing, the tax, keeping the tax decrease. I've been very frustrated with the reporting that no one seems to comment on the fact that for the working poor under $20,000 a year, since the earned income tax credit and the making work pay tax credits go away in this deal, and the 2% FICA, which is questionable to use that in itself, people on the lower levels are going to be seeing a tax increase. It's very frustrating that nobody's even acknowledging it, and it's awful. It's really awful. The other salient, I think what we are going to hear is in the State of the Union is another call for export-driven growth and the free trade agreements, et cetera. And it seems to me that's, in some ways, I regard that as a frank admission that, you know, demand in this country because of the impoverishment of the middle class now, much less the working poor, is not adequate to keep industry going. We can't do this project that you were speaking of. We have to sell it to the elites in other countries, and it's also very distressing. I had myriad points, but why don't I leave it at that? Thanks a lot.
Thank you, caller. Those are great points. And let's start, Bob, with the tax deal, the recent tax deal. I think there was some tension to the extension of the Bush tax cuts to the very wealthiest Americans. The caller refers to sort of the short end of the stick being given to those at the other end of the spectrum. What can you tell us about that deal?
Well, you know, we heard Obama say, you know, I hate it, but I have to do it. You know, I'm not a Washington inside political type person, of course. I think there's some truth in that, and that reflects kind of the feeble state of the Democratic Party in terms of connecting with its base. That, okay, and this is no longer the case, but it was the case that, you know, the Democrats had overwhelming majority in both houses, the President of the United States, and then they have to cut this miserable deal with the Republicans in a crisis, because the Republicans are the ones that are going to hold out and, you know, not and take no hostages and fight to the bitter end. And why are the Democrats not responding to their base, and why are they responding to the Republicans? I mean, that seems to me the fundamental question. And, of course, it ties in with this issue of unions, because unions are a very important part of the Democrats' base. So the issue there is how do we revive the Democratic Party's left base to pressure? I mean, I never thought Obama was going to be politically that much different than Clinton, certainly different personality-wise, and historically to have a black president was, you know, a great moment. But I'm not kind of surprised by Obama's stance, other than the fact that he doesn't feel any pressure from the left. I thought he would feel a lot more pressure from the left. So the tax deal to me was a reflection of the fact that this is where the corporate Democrats see where they need to be, and that is very unfortunate.
Well, let me just interject. The caller was asking or mentioning, and I wasn't fully aware of this, so I wanted you to weigh in on this, that part of the tax deal also was cutting back on some of the provisions that assisted lower-income Americans. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, that is my understanding. The caller did mention some details, and I don't know if those. I don't know those, so I'm assuming he's right. I will say that the earned income tax credit is an important supplement to lower income people, and and myself and others at our research institute have talked about. I've been writing about ways of actually extending it, and so the fact that it's being chipped away is very serious, especially when wages are falling.
Well, let's go to the second part of the caller's question, which was his prediction that export-driven growth will be one of the hallmarks of our policy going forward, sort of a frank recognition that the domestic demand won't be sufficient to bail out our economy and get growth kicking in.
Yeah.
Do you buy that? And what do you make of these trade deals?
Well, yes. The notion that we're going to export our way out of this, of course, every country is trying to do the same thing. I mean, this is the phrase that came out of the 1930s around exactly the same issue was called beggar thy neighbor. So, because if we're going to export more, we need somebody else to be buying what we sell, and that means they're going to be buying less within their own country. So, you know, I'm not against the U.S. exporting, and I think there's some, you know, good reasons to export more. But the notion that this is going to fundamentally drive the economy is an idea that every country wants to pursue, and that will entail all kinds of trade skirmishes, if not wars. We've seen a bit of it already with respect to, you know, issues around the dollar versus Chinese currency versus the euro. What we really need is for all the countries to push up wages and increase buying power by working people in their own countries. That is the egalitarian solution, and that's a stable solution that does not create the kind of tension. So the export model is right, as the caller said. It's a sign that our policy elite do not want to think about increasing living standards for workers in our own country. Again, another marker as to the very severe problems that we face in policymaking, especially with the mainstream Democrats.
We've got a full bank of callers waiting to speak with our guest, Bob Polen, the economist from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So please be patient if you're on the line, so I promise I'll get to everyone. Let's now go to line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Robert Polen.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned the measure of productivity of the American worker has doubled in only a matter of decades or what have you.
Uh-huh.
But how much has this number been artificially inflated by outsourcing to cheap labor? So in other words, the way that all these, you know, Wall Street fat cats are making their big bucks is simply because they can rely on cheap labor overseas, where they don't have to deal with organization and unions and even care about providing them health care, anything like that. And you mentioned, like, green economy as being an example of one area where, like, America's, education level would be of benefit. But even in this case, there was just an article in the New York Times that one of our top solar panel makers is moving to China, which is due partly, I'm sure, to their government subsidies, but certainly also the fact that an engineer, just as trained as any engineer in America, can be obtained over there for half the price.
Right.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Those are two very interesting questions. And I guess if I can paraphrase or rephrase that first part of it, Bob Pollan, this whole thing about productivity, I think, is something that's very confusing to a layperson, how this is measured. Can you clear up what you meant by that and how it refers to the caller's question?
Well, the basic measure of what productivity is supposed to measure is how much any worker, you go to work for a day or a week, how much you produce in the course of the day. And the idea is that through improving technology, giving more workers more machinery to work with, productivity is supposed to go up steadily, or organizing the workplace better. And productivity does go up. there are difficult issues in the measurement of productivity, and the caller mentioned some, which are, okay, if you're importing products that are from other countries that are cheaper, and then those get integrated into the U.S. workplace, that could seem like it's contributing to productivity. All that said, I think it's fair to say, if you look at the number I was quoting was the official statistics from the government, and that does tell us from 1970 to today, the average productivity of a worker is twice today what it was in 1970. Now, that could be off, but it's not going to be off by that much. Let's say it's off by a lot. Let's say it's off by 30%. That tells us the average worker still is producing 70% more than they did in 1970. And that cannot compete with the fact that the average worker is getting paid 7 or 8% less than they got. So this divergence, this severe demarcation between what workers make on the job in terms of their production versus what they earn for their efforts, this is actually historically unprecedented in the U.S., as far as I know, and looking at the literature, that there should be such a sharp disparity. And it is, not, as I said, not only is it unjust, but it is destabilizing, and it moving all that extra money up to the top is what, fuels the hyper-speculation on Wall Street.
Before we go to our next callers, and I do want to reassure the people waiting on the lines, I will get to them. I want to make sure, Bob, you talk about one thing we haven't talked about yet, which is how the news media, in your opinion, covers these issues we've been talking about today, the central economic issues of our times, the policy issues. How good of a job are they doing informing Americans of what's going on, drawing them into the debate, laying out various options and positions, holding politicians accountable, the nuts and bolts of what a free press in theory is supposed to do in a self-governing society?
Well, I mean, now that we have the Internet, there are a lot of outlets that are good. I mean, here's your show. I mean, you certainly know what you're talking about, and you're giving a lot to your listeners, and there are, your colleagues and people like you, people like John Nichols, your colleague at The Nation, is outstanding. And everyone can have access to these things through the Internet. On the other hand, of course, the big, powerful mainstream media, they're really terrible. I mean, we were talking about at the outset, the very notion that the overarching problem today is, the deficit is too big, and now it's shifting to that the public sector unions are getting too much. I mean, how in the world did we reach that point from the where we were 2 years ago when it was, you know, plain as day that Wall Street had destroyed our economic base, and that still holds. So everyone is getting blamed now, except for Wall Street, and they're getting their big bonuses, and the stock market has come back. And here's a story. My coworker Jeanette Wicks Lim is working with the service sector union SEIU in New Haven, Connecticut, where she just wrote a piece that the city is trying to destroy the jobs of the custodial workers in the schools. I mean, they're cutting their wages in more or less in half. I mean, and that's seen as a solution to their budget crisis. I mean, how in the world did custodial workers end up being the ones that have to bear the brunt of these adjustments is just outrageous. But it's the kind of thing that, like I said, the cover story in this week's Economist magazine, which is often a voice of, you know, where the mainstream thinking is going on economic issues, saying that, you know, it's time to bust the public sector unions.
And on these lines, and I do, before we get back to the phone calls, I want to pursue this point one step further, because you've talked about this throughout the show, which is the policies being advocated by the Tea Party and the Republican Party, which are sort of anti-Keynesian. They're the policies that basically deny the Depression, deny the traditional understanding of why we have these economic crises, and say that we should balance the budget immediately and pay down the national debt as soon as humanly possible and lower wages as much as possible to encourage investment, to make it more attractive to invest. I mean, were those policies actually put into place right now, the governing of this country were to implement slashing Social Security to level off, to have a balanced budget immediately in the next 12 months and every budget in the public budget balanced, I mean, what would be the effect on the economy?
Well, it would be disastrous, which is why, despite all the rhetoric, I mean, you know, the tax cut deal, awful as it is, both parties knew that that was better than doing what they've been really talking about, which is exactly what you're saying, balancing the budget. I mean, if you're really serious about balancing the budget, you do not start giving away tax cuts. You raise taxes, and they didn't do that. So they didn't take their own rhetoric seriously. And so instead, we are giving away more to rich people and rather than doing the things that they're talking about. But the fact is, I mean, you know, in Britain they're going through it now. In Greece they're going through it now because they have imposed austerity. We all saw those riots of students in Britain because of the tuitions going up three times. And, you know, if that's what... And I just gave you a small example. Okay, now we're going to start busting public sector unions in a liberal town like New Haven, Connecticut. We're going to cut in half the wages of custodial workers, and they're the ones that are going to bear the brunt of this crisis in our city. And we will start seeing more stories like that unless we acknowledge that the federal government has to support social spending, support state and local governments. And that is also a way out of the crisis. If they don't do that, we're going to start seeing layoffs of teachers, more custodial workers. We're going to see layoffs of public safety workers. And I'm not so sure that our politicians, even the Republicans, are really going to have the stomach for that.
It also strikes me as economic suicide, because who's going to be buying products if everyone's out of work?
But that's right.
Let's go to line four now, Spring Bay. You're on the air with our guest today, Robert Poland from the University of Massachusetts. Spring Bay, he's all yours.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I read the website The Automatic Earth, and they talk about extend and pretend, and that we are in the early stages of major deflationary cycle. And I guess maybe that we're eventually going to end up where you were just talking about lower wages and salaries and all of that. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that point of view of moving into a deflationary cycle. And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that, frankly, terrific question. And this is an issue I'm personally very interested in for a number of reasons. And I know it's difficult to answer in a lay manner, but I trust we have the right person for the job, Bob.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That is a very good question. So what the caller is talking about is when we inflation is something we're familiar with, which is prices going up, and we always think about the economy being one in which prices always do go up, maybe slowly, maybe more rapidly, but always going up. As the caller said, the real danger at the moment is deflation, which is if prices go down. Well, that sounds like, oh, good, you know, prices are going down. But actually, that is an extremely dangerous situation because if price the immediate danger is precisely with the financial markets, because if prices go down and workers' wages are going down, that means it's going to be more difficult to pay off debts. So that means that if you owe $100 this year and you're going to still owe it next year, but your wage has gone down, that makes it more difficult for you to pay your $100. So we'll start to see more defaults. We'll start to see more foreclosures. We'll see more financial instability. Actually, the Federal Reserve, Bernanke, is aware of this, and that's why he instituted this so-called quantitative easing policy, which was just a fancy term. It was a distraction to come up with this new term. It was really a way to try to be more aggressive in pushing up the economy and actually promoting inflation because they're afraid of deflation. So this is a great fear because also deflation is something we really haven't had at all. And so we'd be moving into uncharted territories. And if you start having a deflationary spiral, it'll make the last financial crisis look mild by comparison.
I mean, Bob, isn't it, to add to this, isn't it really sort of a black hole for a capitalist economy? Because as soon as people anticipate prices are going to fall, they're going to stop buying stuff because they'll wait till the prices get lower.
Yeah, well, that is part of the fact. You know, right now the banks, our banks, they're getting essentially free money to borrow from the Federal Reserve, and now they're sitting on $1 trillion, and they won't lend it, they won't invest, and part of the explanation is exactly that they think, well, there's even better deals coming in a deflationary economy. We can buy more with less money. So why would we want to do it now? So it's a very serious, extremely severe problem, and it's good that the caller brought it up.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again, Bob Pohl, an economist from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Let's go now to another very patient caller, this time line one, Peoria. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay. Illinois did raise their taxes recently, and then there's a bulldozer factory here in town. I don't know if I can say names, but the CEO said complained about the tax hike, and saying that's going to drive business out of Illinois. He was interviewed in the Peoria Journal Star, a local paper. We talk about media, and then I think in the same issue of the paper, the bulldozer factory said that they were going to open a plant in Thailand, which was, you know, if he's saying that, gee, in the future they might leave Illinois. Well, they are already. And but at any rate, also, I am retired, and I volunteer in a food pantry. And I see people coming in from the bulldozer factory subcontractors because they had a different union agreement years ago that allowed subcontractors to be hired. And people are coming in work for subcontractors for the bulldozer factory, and these used to be middle class incomes, and they're not, they're gone now. And okay, I'll let you comment on that.
Well, thank you, caller. Bob Pohlen?
Well, I think what's clear is we have to have a government policy that aggressively commits to the idea of creating decent jobs. And as we've seen coming out of the crisis, the government does have enormous leverage. You know, it was the leverage that got us out of the leverage. And so, I mean, is more important to people than having decent employment opportunities. And so this is, yes, of course, there are businesses are going to make these threats. And there are reasons that businesses are going to say, well, we might as well just go overseas. But if we have a government commitment to creating manufacturing jobs, to supporting it, and government commitment to maintaining a strong public sector and reducing health care costs in a serious way, including for businesses, these are the things that will sustain and revive employment in the Midwest, in Peoria, and elsewhere. And without that, yes, without that, there are going to be constant pressures for businesses to say, well, the hell with it, we'll go overseas. Now, that is the real fundamental issue that I think is at stake, and I had hoped that, you know, the Democratic Party, after the 2008 election, had gotten the message, but that it seems that they really haven't gotten it, at least not entirely yet.
Let's go now to line two for another caller, Las Cruces, New Mexico. Thank you for calling us here at Media Matters. You're on the air with Bob Polam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in, well, I have some questions about rhetorical stances that we can take from the left. So often the debate, as we know, becomes so easily polarized, and when we talk about economics, it's generally an understanding of the market, the free market on the one hand, versus regulation and or centralization on the other hand, where the free market is understood almost exclusively in neoliberal terms, and regulation and centralization is being pushed towards an equation with socialism. So the question that I have is, if we're arguing from the left, whether in conversations with family members or writing op-eds or to the degree that we're proposing projects or grants or political intervention, how can we speak in an effective way about capturing productivity gains for workers, for instance? You've mentioned that a little bit in terms of labor unions. Is that the only solution? Are there other strategies that we can advocate for? Also, how can we speak about efficiency? Because it seems like when you're speaking with a conservative about economic matters, any attempt to talk about regulation or anything that's not free and unobstructed markets a la the neoliberal model is immediately equated with inefficiency. And I personally don't think that's true, but outside of proposing, you know, sort of larger visions for how an economy could work, it's very hard to talk about how we can capture efficiency gains in a non-free market neoliberal way. And then finally, is there any way to bring up the bogeyman of socialism where it won't be understood necessarily as a centralized model a la the Soviet Union?
Well, those are great questions, Las Cruces. And Bob, you've only got about a minute and a half or 2 minutes to answer, but I want to start, if you would start on the last one. I was astonished, I don't know about you, to see those polls in the last year or two by the BBC and a couple of other pollsters of Americans that showed that the notion of socialism actually had a pretty positive resonance, particularly among Americans under the age of 30.
Yeah, well, you know, I count myself as a democratic socialist. The problem is, you know, what it really means. And to me, it's just more productive and to think about things in more specific and concrete terms. And so, but the fact is that, you know, regulation can be much more efficient than unregulated situation. I mean, the most obvious case is the financial markets. We had an unregulated financial market. Talk about inefficiency. I mean, it was on the verge of destroying the entire global economy. And it was the, you know, clunky old government and in all the, you know, stupid ways that we went about it. But it was the government bailouts that prevented the free market, the unregulated market, from destroying everyone's livelihood. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, whether it means we do something called socialism or not, you know, it's an interesting debate, but I don't think the label works much one way or another. I mean, Newsweek magazine had the cover saying, oh, we're all socialists now, but then what did it really mean? It meant European government style, and I don't know, it doesn't seem to get me, when I get involved in debates like this, it doesn't seem to get me very far, either positively or negatively. It just kind of invokes a lot of argument about things that don't seem to advance the debate. So
on that note, Bob Polam, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
Oh, okay.
I guess they want to clear us out of the room here to go to the next show. I want to thank you, Robert Polam, for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters.
Oh, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you, and thanks to all the callers.
All right, and I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, and the engineer Kyle Kroha for their great work. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580, and we'll be back in 167 hours. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.